The prolonged, costly, and embittered steel strike has caused many of our people to do some basic thinking on labor management relationship in our country. At the moment, steel workers are returning to their jobs under a federal injunction. They are doing so reluctantly and under protest. The issues have not been settled, and no employment contracts have been signed. If negotiations fail during the period of the injunction, and if after 60 days no agreement is reached, and if in a secret ballot conducted by the National Labor Relations Board, the steel workers turn down the last offer which will be made by the companies, the injunction, which lasted strike, which lasted 116 days, the longest strike on record, and which was preceded by 5 months of fruitless negotiation, will be resumed, the mills will be shut down again, and the disastrous cycle of widening unemployment and spreading industrial paralysis will start all over again. This long drawn out steel strike has aroused strong partisan passions. In the heat of any major conflict, things are said which upon reflection had better been left unsaid. A strike is a form of warfare, and in war, many restraints and decencies are abandoned. Propaganda takes over, and reason and fairness are for the duration almost suspect on both sides. Thus, spokesmen for the industry have branded the spokesmen for the steel workers as union bosses who are concerned not with the real welfare of the members of their union, but with their own power and prestige. They have charged that the demands of labor would undermine the economy of the United States by contributing to an inflationary spiral. The steel union is on strike for more inflation, reads a full-page advertisement of the steel company's coordinating committee. The steel union is on strike for more inflation. And to accept the union demands would simply price the steel industry out of competition with foreign markets. Now, some union spokesmen retorted that the companies, by refusing to accede to their demands and by their own counter-proposals, were trying to impose an industrial tyranny upon the workers, were engaging in a public be damned jungle warfare, and were applying the black snake whip on the backs of the workers. Now, the average citizen, I suspect, has not been greatly impressed by these heated arguments on both sides. The steel industry was never particularly noted for its disinterested patriotism, its spontaneous altruism, or its readiness to curb its own appetite for profits out of any concern for inflation. The profits of the industry in recent years, after making due allowance for taxes and appreciation and replacement, have been enormous. And no one begrudges the steel industry its profits, and our system of private enterprise cannot operate without profits. But at no time during the recent inflationary trend has the steel industry offered to cut the cost of steel per ton as a token contribution to a lowering of prices and a leveling off in inflation. Of course, the problem of inflation exists and is our nation's most serious and urgent economic problem. It affects us all. The increased cost of all things and the decrease in the purchasing power of the dollar are impoverishing millions of our people who live on fixed incomes. And this trend may assume before long catastrophic proportions. This problem is nationwide in scope and can only be met by national action in which our federal government, working in concert with industry, labor, the farmer, the banker, will launch a comprehensive program to check inflation. It is not the task of any one single industry to attempt to enforce a solution unilaterally, and that at the expense of its workers exclusively. In the most recent issue of the Harvard Business Review, I read a very interesting article written by Professor Lawrence G. Levengood called American Business and the Piety of Profits. And in it, the professor makes some very interesting observations. He writes, "A business firm, even if it owns the town, is only one element within the community. The assumption of complete identity of interest may lead businessmen stealthily to the view that no one knows better than they what the community interest is, even though their vantage point is surely as much off the one angle as that of any other interested group. Immodest claims," he writes, "immodest claims by businessmen to guardianship of the public welfare can excite in the public an unfortunate belief that businessmen have the knowledge and the power by themselves to solve the problems caused by and affecting society at large. When social problems, which be it remembered, are defined finally by society and not by businessmen alone, when social problems cannot be remedied satisfactorily by business decisions, then at the end, the public is inclined to give businessmen an immoderate share of the blame for the fact that the problems exist at all. And if inflation does exist," he writes, "if inflation exists, most industries probably have an interest in seeing it tamed. But it is fanciful to suppose that one or another industry can do an appreciable amount of taming by itself. End of quote. It is true, of course, that American industry is today encountering serious competition from abroad in many fields, not only in steel. Foreign countries whose economic recovery was accelerated by American grants and subsidies and loans, these foreign countries have now recovered to a point where they can compete with us successfully in foreign markets and in our own. And they are helped in their competition by the wages which they pay their workers. And these wages are considerably lower than ours. So, of course, is the standard of living of their workers. Their workers haven't the homes and the cars and the refrigerators and the washing machines, nor the food that many of our workers have. What then? Is it suggested that in order to meet competition from abroad, the wages of our workers should be cut down to their level? What then will become of our industries which are producing these very consumers' goods, which our workers will then not be able to buy? The solution for this problem too, the problem of competition from abroad, cannot be placed at the doorsteps of the American workers exclusively. Industry, through more efficient methods of production, through modernization, through new inventions, aided, wherever necessary, by government, should face this problem in the future as in the past. And in this regard, it should be noted, the steel industry has not suffered in recent years because of the high wages which it has paid. Its sales increased, its profits increased, the number of workers employed remained constant or actually decreased, and the output per man per hour increased. And steel wages and profits are ahead of those of industry generally in our country. Has the steel industry then no case at all in the present dispute? I believe that it has. Not so much in the area of wage increases as in the area of work rules and practices. The government's fact-finding board reported that the two sides were only 1 cent apart in wages and only a few cents apart on the total. Management has asked for a revision in certain work rules, which it claims make for waste and inefficiency. They would like to eliminate what they call feather bedding, make work practices, keeping men on the payrolls who are not needed. They've made other proposals. The union has rejected these demands out of hand as a backward step designed to break the union. It sees nothing amiss in the present work practices in the mills. It is afraid that changing the rules will open the way to reducing crew sizes for the same workload, introducing harmful speed-ups and other undesirable labor practices. It is prepared to to submit the whole matter for further study to a joint committee. Industry, however, would like to have its proposals submitted at once to a three-man board of arbitration, with one member from management, one from labor, one selected by management and the union. And this arbitration board would consider what changes, if any, were to be made in the rules to improve efficiency with due regard for the welfare of the employees. Now, fair-minded people who have no axe to grind are of the opinion that there is some merit in the steel industry's desire to eliminate waste and increase economy and production, and that labor would not be hurt by it. Certain shop practices and work rules do become outmoded after a time, and I understand that the present rules are some 15 years old, during which many changes have taken place in the industry. It is not reasonable to assume that an impartial board of arbitration, after a careful study of these proposals, would impose unfair work rules upon the workers. If, however, labor does find, by experience, during the life of this contract, that one or another of the revised rules is grossly unfair, the issue, of course, could be reopened before the next labor contract is signed 2 or 3 years hence. It should, however, be borne in mind that the problem of eliminating so-called feather bedding from industry is part of a larger and more serious problem created by the radical changes which are taking place in American industry as a result of automation, the application of electronics and electrical devices to production. Now, ultimately, this shift from old-time machine operation to automatic flow and processes will increase production and will open up new frontiers of economic opportunity which will benefit labor, consumer, and investor alike. But in the process, just as in the earlier processes, when machinery which displaced hand labor and labor-saving devices generally were first introduced, men will be displaced. The so-called blue-collar workers, that is, those who are engaged in production and maintenance, and who at the moment constitute the overwhelming membership of American trade unions. The blue-collar workers are being steadily displaced by white-collar workers. In some industries, for example, in the electrical and equipment industry, the production and maintenance workers have actually already been outnumbered by the white-collar worker, the technician, the engineer, the computer, etc. While it is, of course, undesirable and quite impossible to check these modern technological changes which are coming about in industry, provision must be made to take care of the men who are forced out by the new processes. You just can't throw them on the scrap heap or on public relief rolls. And certainly the profits of an industry, which are derived from automation, should, in part at least, be used for retraining and finding new employment for men who have been forced out of their jobs. This is a moral responsibility. This is a social responsibility and an urgent task which confronts both labor and management. As regards the steel workers themselves, the steel workers of America are not an exploited group. In 1958, the average wage paid the American steel worker was something above $3 an hour. Though it should be remembered that steel workers seldom work a full work year. That is sometimes quickly overlooked. But he is certainly not a wage slave. He's strong and self-protected, as he should be. Whatever rights he now possesses, and whatever standard of living he now enjoys, were not given him on a silver platter, either by a solicitor's company or by a socially minded public. He had to fight for them, as most organized laboring men have had to do in our country. But having finally arrived at this point, he must no longer talk or truculently think of himself in terms of a wage slave. At the exciting and very revealing meeting which was held between the Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and seven prominent American union officials in San Francisco last September, the very skillful and adroit Soviet propagandist Khrushchev taunted the American labor leaders. They were, he said, capitalist lackeys who are misleading the American working men, who are nothing more than wage slaves. Whereupon Walter Reuther, president of the United Auto Workers, threw across the table to Khrushchev a list of United States wage rates and said, "How can you say these people are wage slaves, exploited by capitalism, making this kind of wages in America? How can you say that they have nothing to lose but their chains?" To which Khrushchev replied rather lamely, "We say what we do in retaliation for what you say about us." Now, since American labor is where it is today, it is incumbent upon its enlightened leaders, when engaged in negotiations for renewed contracts on wages, work rules, or any other matter, to bear in mind that they are not fighting for the same rudimentary, indispensable bedrock human rights of a generation or two ago. It is now possible for them to be more flexible, to give as well as to take, without sacrificing any of the real gains which have been won by labor, and without retarding the future progress of the American working man. You do not abandon your goal by accepting a temporary compromise. It must be clear to both labor and management that the American people will not indefinitely tolerate 116-day strikes, will not stand idly by and suffer serious economic dislocation and loss and hazards to health and security while two contending parties are fighting it out and are waiting for unconditional surrender. The issues today are not such that they must be solved by unconditional surrender. It should be remembered that collective bargaining implies bargaining. And bargaining implies give and take. The old idea of a good bargain, once declared Justice Brandeis, the old idea of a good bargain was a transaction in which one man got the better of another. The new idea of a good contract, he said, is a transaction which is good for both parties to it. That is sound economic statesmanship. And neither the steel industry nor the union seems to have been compellingly aware of this simple fact in the present crisis. It is told of a farmer who once came to Abraham Lincoln when he was a lawyer in Springfield and asked Mr. Lincoln to institute divorce proceedings at once. He wanted to divorce his wife, but there was a trouble, asked Mr. Lincoln. Well, for a long time, said the farmer, we were poor, we lived in a log cabin. More recently, we made some money, and we bought a frame house, more comfortable. And the question arose how to paint the house. I suggested that we paint it white, like all our neighbors were doing. My wife preferred brown. So we debated the question for a long time and finally had disputes and then had serious quarrels. This would be going on for months. I want a divorce. Can't live anymore with my wife. Whereupon Mr. Lincoln said, divorce is a very serious matter. You've lived together these many years. You have children. Better think it over. Go home. See whether you can't work out a compromise. Come back to me. Come back within a month. After 4 weeks, the farmer came back and said to Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Lincoln, drop the proceedings at once. We've made a compromise. So, said Mr. Lincoln, what is the compromise? Well, we have agreed to paint the house brown. If this is the kind of compromise that labor and management are expecting in this dispute, it is, I'm afraid, one very difficult indeed to achieve. President Eisenhower has been criticized for invoking the Taft-Hartley Act. I personally question whether there is much merit to this law. I have right along. But it is in our statute books, and the president had no choice whatsoever but to invoke it. Perhaps he should have intervened much earlier in the dispute by appointing a fact-finding board with the right to make recommendations for a settlement. Many of us think that the president waited too long. When on the 64th day of the strike, he finally did offer to appoint such a board, industry rejected it, and the president abandoned the idea altogether. President Eisenhower, however, was right when, moving to get a court injunction to halt the strike, he declared, America's hopes for a voluntary, responsible settlement have not been fulfilled. It is a sad day for the nation. It is a sad day for the nation. End of quote. For when labor and management in key industries can no longer bargain collectively, and can no longer in a reasonable period of time reach an agreement, then there can be recourse only to a few things. Either to group dictatorship, which is fascism, which is communism, or to government intervention and control through the democratic process. Fortunately, we're not on the eve of the former alternatives, fascism or communism, but the latter alternative, government intervention, is certainly around the corner. And we assume that neither labor nor management want any of it. How then do they plan to avert it? Free citizens in this country would rather not resort to compulsion to settle labor disputes. The United States Supreme Court struck down some years ago as unconstitutional state statutes which made arbitration of labor disputes mandatory. But if collective bargaining does not work, as this long drawn-out steel strike has demonstrated, something else must take its place. And that something cannot be strikes. For while the right to strike is the laboring man's charter of freedom, which he should never surrender, society today can no longer tolerate prolonged strikes in essential industries without endangering its own very life. President Truman, certainly a friend of labor, was driven by necessity in 1952 to order the Secretary of Commerce to seize and operate the nation's steel mills, to avert a strike by 600,000 CIO United Steelworkers. And prior to that time, in August of 1950, President Truman ordered the Army to seize all railroads to prevent a general strike after the unions had rejected terms of settlement. And thoughtful workers themselves have also come to question the practical wisdom of these long drawn out strikes, which cost them more in pay loss than they can ever recover in years of employment, even if their strike is won. Now, all these facts, in my humble judgment, when faced honestly and fairly, all these facts point urgently to the need of a higher order of statesmanship to assert itself on the part both of labor and management. A higher order of statesmanship. Five strikes in 10 years in the steel industry does not speak well for the statesmanship either of labor or management. It is a sorry record of lack of vision and plain good common sense. Secretary of Labor James P. Mitchell was, in our judgment, entirely correct when he accused recently both sides in the present controversy of shirking their responsibility to the nation. Industry waited 80 days after the strike began before it made its first money proposal. Why? This has given ground to the suspicion that the companies really wanted and welcomed a summer stoppage of production in order to reduce their large inventories of high-priced steel without reducing prices. And they perhaps figured also that the time was propitious to get tough with labor. Since labor had had an unfavorable press and public opinion as a result of the congressional investigation into some labor racketeering unions and malpractices. If this higher statesmanship does not promptly assert itself, then government will either be forced to appoint a board to make findings and impose a settlement, or it will have to seize and operate the steel plants. In order to avert additional government intervention, I would suggest, as a private citizen, who is a friend both of organized labor and management, I would suggest, in order to avert further government intervention, that labor and management in the steel industry invite forthwith, a group of public-spirited men, three or five laymen or religious leaders or both, on whose judgment and fairness they can rely to render a decision in this dispute. The facts are all in. The decision can be rendered quickly. This is not compulsory arbitration. It will not have been made mandatory by any act of government. It will not necessarily set any precedent. It will be purely voluntary on their part, and it should be a very welcome, and a face-saving solution all around, which will get both parties out of this seemingly hopeless impasse into which they have maneuver themselves. Strikes have been settled in the past on this basis. It seems to me at the moment to be the most promising way of ending this terrible deadlock, which, if it is not ended, may lead to many unfortunate things, not only in the steel industry, in industry generally in our country, things which neither labor nor management nor we the public of a free democracy really